Bourbon and Brown Town is an affiliate podcast of Soapbox Production and Organizing that pairs critical analyses of media, culture, politics, and everyday happenings with the tastiest of spirits. With the occasional help of Chicago's most talented and creative artists, activists, filmmakers, academics, and social entrepreneurs, Brown Town unpacks current events, social issues, and gives personal insight into various topics.
Soapbox is a film and social activism nonprofit that specializes in multimedia curation of creative projects centered around education, entertainment, and structural social change for a more equitable and creative world. So for this episode, sit back, sip something good, and enjoy.
I've been really grateful for this movement to start that conversation and bring it out into the light, and people that wouldn't necessarily be having these conversations are having them, and I think that's very important.
I want to welcome everyone to another installment of Bourbon in Brown Town. I am your host, David of Brown Town, always my boy Colin of Brown Town. Colin, man, how you doing?
I am feeling fine.
Fine.
That's like partially why I'm kind of stressed. But but in all the grand scheme of things, I'm feeling good. How are you?
You know, I'm just so hyped that we finally have, like, this space to be able to continue to do what we're doing.
This space, where are we, David?
Man, for everyone who doesn't know, Cards Against Humanity has sort of a shared space in where they have a studio for podcasts, mainly, like, comedy-related of sorts, because that's, you know, where they start with. But they open it up to other podcasts here in Chicago, and we have the opportunity to finally be here and... It's super cool. The place is super dope. You know, we might be doing some live episodes at some point. I don't see why not.
Y'all better come through.
You know, and we have always the fantastic Harambe as well joining us. He's also peeping it out. He's going to be a little quiet, but he might say something here and there. We'll see where that goes.
Just drop knowledge.
Maybe just dropping bars. So on today's episode, we're going to be talking about something that I don't really... Like, we've kind of touched on in very small... points here and there, but I'm really excited, especially with the guests that we have. Today we're going to be talking about fighting for women's rights through faith, public policy, and the hashtag MeToo movement. As the hashtag MeToo has come into saliency, you know, it's one of the mainstream movements of our day. You know, we don't oftentimes look at how faith, public policy, and grassroots all actions are all working towards women's rights and true gender equality, right? I don't know about you, but like when we were first thinking about this as a subject, I was like, we're going to be touching on all three? Like how, Sway? Like how? But I guess without further ado, Colin, could you introduce our guests out there to everyone listening?
Absolutely. With us, we have the honor and privilege of having Miss Zoe Goodman. If y'all don't know, Zoe is a racial and gender justice advocate who has 5 years of a nonprofit experience, including time as a teacher in a Title I charter school. Mm. She has lived in Colorado, Tennessee, New Jersey, Illinois, and has been really happy living in Brooklyn for the last 3 years.
Boo. No, I'm
just town. jokes all around. Volunteerism has been an important part of her life as far back as she can remember. However, really thoughtful advocacy and social justice involvement started when she moved to Evanston, Illinois in high school. Mm-hmm. Zoe is a Jewish woman proudly from an interfaith family raised in a Lutheran church. She's a certified confidential victim advocate for survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence and a longtime abortion clinic escort. Zoe, what is good?
Hey, I am so happy to be finally joining you. I've been listening to Bourbon and Brown Town. It's the only podcast that I listen to. I'm not a big podcaster, and so... I feel really proud and honored to be here tonight.
I think what you mean to say is you're a huge podcaster, but you found one that
speaks
rules
to you.
All the other ones. And there's no need to speak to any other podcast.
All the podcasts. Right, one podcast to rule them all.
There you go. But that's really sweet of you to say. And then for everyone who don't know, Zoe's actually hanging out with us all the way from New York. So thank you for taking the time, you know, to chill out with us just for a few minutes. So as we were talking about, we have faith, we have public policy, we have grassroots actions and things like that. And we all understand that all these avenues get pushed back, you know, whether you want to say through powerful institutions, just dickheads, you know, every step of the way. Something that we're always looking at is how can we, you know, better understand, you know, the polarizing present and, but still be consciously optimistic about the future. And so could you tell us a little bit about some of the work that you're currently doing right now? And then we can kind of transition the conversation into it.
Yeah, sure. So professionally, I'm in the nonprofit sector, and I work for an organization whose mission is to help build the financial security of the working poor in America. So I work with organizations all over the country to train staff to do financial coaching. But then I also work with organizational leadership at those different nonprofits, primarily in the workforce development space, to help build organizational capacity to keep offering financial coaching for sort of years in the future. So that's what I do professionally now. But I also am an abortion clinic escort on the weekends in Queens, New York, just not too far from where I live. Mm-hmm. And I have been really involved in volunteering specifically around sort of abortion access and domestic violence, intimate partner violence over the last couple of years.
Damn.
How, like, I've heard of so you help take people into clinics to get abortions, right? You ever gone where there's people who with picket signs and shit outside, yelling at them or some shit? That's happened?
Yeah. So the clinic, the reason that we have abortion clinic escorts is because there are, we call them antis, but there are anti-choice folks standing outside of abortion clinics trying to prevent women, their partners, their families from accessing what I would consider to be pretty basic healthcare. So many abortion clinics in the United States also provide other services like mammograms, like pap smears, STI screening. Many folks walking into clinics are there for a mammogram, and are being screamed at by protesters. So the clinic that I am a volunteer at is in, like I said, Queens, New York, and we've got about 20 to 25 protesters a week who come out and stand outside with really big sort of the graphic signs that you've seen. If you ever Google abortion clinic protests, they're the really graphic, factually inaccurate signs depicting what they would call an abortion. And my job as a clinic escort is to stand outside the clinic and make sure that folks are able to walk safely into the clinic. And to be honest, it really is just about sort of easing what can be kind of a tense or anxious walk for folks.
Yeah.
Because in New York City, the clinic sits right on the sidewalk. And so folks can stand wherever they want. And so antis will be, we're walking, we're all right next to each other on the sidewalk. And so I walk up, I've been at this particular clinic for several years now. And I'm actually an escort lead there. And I say hi to the antis when I walk up. I know them all. They're there every week. I'm there most weeks. It's just sort of part, hey, good morning. How you doing? And then they spend the next 3.5 hours yelling.
Have drinks afterwards and stuff.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. We all just hang out on the weekends. Then they spend the next 3 hours telling me that, I'm Hitler and that I think, black babies should die and, that I'm here sort of as part of a racial genocide, in my role as an abortion clinic escort. And then we all leave.
Tell me a little bit about that. I'm sorry. I kind of cut you off earlier and I feel like this conversation particularly, I need to not do that. Tell me about the racial component of that and the optics of it. Because you're in Queens, you're obviously a white woman. This is a black area. Why do they feel the need and the validity to say those things to you? And how do you feel about that, especially with the experiences you've had and the work you've done before?
Right. So I think as a little bit of background, I have been doing also racial justice work for a really long time. And when I moved to Evanston, Illinois in high school, got really involved with the local NAACP there. And so racial justice, stayed involved with the Black Student Alliance in college. Racial justice has always been a really important sort of component in the idea of intersectionality has been a really important component to the gender justice work that I do.
Sure.
And I am a white woman. I'm a white Jewish woman, but was raised in the Lutheran church, and we can come back to that. But when we look at folks who are getting abortions in the United States, 75% of them are poor or low income. And a disproportionately high number of them are Black women. This tends to be because of restricted access to contraception and restricted access to other types of high quality reproductive health care. So this isn't that Black women are necessarily seeking abortions at a higher rate because that's what Black women do. It's that Black women typically don't have access to the kind of really high quality health care that white women have. That would prevent the need for an abortion. And I want to be very clear on this because I think we tiptoe around abortion generally in the United States. You hear a lot of apologizing for abortion. You hear folks in power like abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And I want to be very clear that I think abortion should happen whenever the person who is carrying that fetus wants it to happen, period. If it is your first abortion, if it is your 10th abortion, abortion is always an acceptable option for a woman to pursue if that's the choice that she wants to make. So I want to make sure that I'm clear about that because I think, again, a lot of times we talk about, and I've already said this, these clinics provide other services. And I share that because it's true. Like these clinics often do provide other services, right. But I don't say that to apologize for the fact that they provide abortion. That's just so that we're all on the same page about what's happening at these clinics.
Yeah.
So just answer your question. Again, disproportionately high numbers of Black women specifically are choosing abortion. But the protesters at my particular clinic, most of them are Black. And most of the escorts who show up to volunteer are white. And I think I have struggled with this over the years that I've been doing it here in Queens, in part because I want folks in the local community. It is a community that definitely is predominantly non-white. Like the clinic and most of the patients walking into that clinic are women of color and people of color. And so it's important to acknowledge that. But I also think I certainly would not want to present as a white savior, but I also think that there is a stigma associated with not only seeking abortion, but really publicly standing up for abortion. And so I have the opportunity as an outsider in that community to stand up without fear of retribution and without fear of my community judging me for that in a way that like women who live in the neighborhood might feel like we want this service, but we are not able maybe to stand up for it in the way that I can because I don't live there. So I think while I would absolutely love to see more abortion clinic escorts of color at this particular clinic, I also understand why women in the local community might not want to do that. And I want to acknowledge that there's a level of privilege that's associated with being able to wake up at, I wake up at 5:30 in the morning to get out there. I'm out there usually until 11 a.m. It's every Saturday morning. And there's a level of privilege of being able to know that I can control my schedule on Friday nights so that I can get up early. I don't have children at home. And I also don't work on the weekends. So I can take that time to stand in front of a clinic.
Well, one thing I was thinking of is real quick, is just the kind of the shout your abortion kind of movement and kind of like taking everything you just said as far as like being very much looking at the facts, like first and foremost, looking at that this is not a rare thing from their site and kind of their mantras. Abortion is normal. Our stories are ours to tell. This is not a debate. Right. You look at the stats of how frequent it is compared to what people say, especially like. You know, far-right pundits, and then how people think about abortion, especially now, is not what we're told the narrative is. So I feel like that kind of movement is very much reclaiming that narrative, right? And it's, like, backed up by facts, which is awesome. And kind of going to the macro level of the kind of this conversation, like Dave mentioned in the beginning, policy, activism, like, research, and, like, normal working, all those things are kind of in tandem, right? And with the Shout the Abortion is reclaiming the narrative, but also is backed up by like facts and stats and how people actually think. And I think that's kind of comes to what you're saying, which I think is really awesome. I have a question. I'll pitch it to you too, Dave. Maybe it's the same thing. But I'm curious about the religious component of all this. The folks that are out there protesting, I'm assuming these are like religious folks who are kind of saying this is against maybe like God's plan or something like that. And please correct me if I'm wrong. And then adjacent to that, I don't say finding your faith, but practicing your faith, how you do now and how you've kind of come to where you are in your faith. And what if any tension you've had with your fight for women's rights and the way people see faith and how you kind of use biblical texts, religious texts, excuse me, to back up your thoughts and feelings and sentiments and passions.
I like how you always ask like six questions at once. It's not just one fucking question. I normally purpose that. I'm like, you got to write that shit down real quick.
This, A2. Yeah.
So I'm going to tackle the second question you asked and then we'll come back to the first one first. So the second question you asked sort of about the intersection of faith, abortion, and just reproductive health care generally, I think is a really great question. So, and again, you mentioned those facts and it bears repeating. 1 in 4 women in the United States will have an abortion by the time that they're 45. And we have really seen the abortion rate decline pretty drastically over the last 10 years or so. And that really is due to expanded contraception use. That's like sex ed matters. Contraception access matters.
Absence education does not work.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
Absence education does not work.
Right. And I taught, so when I was teaching middle school, I was teaching in the Bible Belt South. I had to sign an AmeriCorps agreement to participate in AmeriCorps and this whole agreement, everything else, there were like 10 things that you had to agree to. And the other 9 were totally reasonable. And then number 10 basically says that during your year of service, you will not refer anybody to abortion or talk about abortion, while you are sort of in your capacity as an AmeriCorps volunteer. And I really struggled with whether or not I was going to sign that. I decided to, and then was like, I'll just do what I want. Fortunately, I was a 7th grade teacher. Fortunately, it didn't come up, right? Sure. Like I didn't have to refer any 12-year-olds, for abortion care. But I felt strongly that like, had it come up, I absolutely would have, I wouldn't have certainly pushed that on anyone, but I would have talked about it with my students as an option. And, so I think sort of all of those things, kind of tie together. But in the last sort of fact that I'm going to throw at you, cause I think it is really, really important.
Give it to me.
About half of abortion patients are living below the federal poverty level. And that's just under $20,000 for a family of 3. That's a little bit of an old stat. It's just a few years old. But 65% of abortions are sought by women making 2 times the federal poverty level and below. And so we're talking about people are choosing abortion because they literally can't afford to have another child. And most women who get an abortion already have at least 1 child, like 66%. It's a pretty staggering statistic. Wow. And so I think we paint in America, or antis paint in America, sort of the picture of what an abortion clinic patient looks like. And it typically is slut shaming. It's typically like, you know, a loose woman just like wants to do whatever she wants with no consequences. And in reality, it's usually women who are making a choice because they know that they won't be able to take care of children they already have if they have another child. And if we were to change, we're talking about public policy. If we were to do a good job on public policy, we would do a couple of things. We would expand access to contraception, like Colorado has done in the long-acting reversible contraception program that they've enacted, which has reduced teen pregnancy by half. Colorado has been just such a leader in sort of this movement. Most sex ed programs in the United States don't conform to CDC recommendations for sex education. most teens who have sex do so before having received any formal education on contraception. So there are a lot of kind of challenges that we have to confront there. But where I'm jumping sort of way ahead, we'll get to abortion policy hopefully a little bit later. But what I'm trying to say here is that if we did a better job on policy that impacts folks in poverty, we would also be addressing abortion. If right. folks who are living in poverty were lifted out of poverty, we would see the abortion rate decline. And so if you hear somebody who is saying that they are pro-life, but are trying to cut welfare or are trying to cut food stamps or are trying to cut other public programs that help make sure that women and families have the care that they need, then essentially what we're saying is that abortion is your only option and Republicans are trying to cut that too. So it, again, we come back to like women are not in control of their bodies when they cannot receive this care. And I totally forgot the faith part and I'll come back to that, but I want to like pause for a second. I got so wrapped up in the stats.
I love the stats. That was amazing.
Yeah.
They were like, don't talk while she's talking. I'm like, you're right. I'm sorry.
I mean, and it's also just interesting to listen, but please do answer that. Cause I'm kind of curious, you know, having grown up, religious, you know, the biggest thing is like, I was worried that, you know, one of my partners was going to have a pregnant. So we're like, oh, like, do we get an abortion sort of thing? So I've had that conversation. I personally have never like had a partner go through it that I am at least aware of. but you know, and I just want to know from your perspective, like how either you've been able to deal with that or how your religious background handles these sorts of things.
So Jews have sort of an interesting perspective on abortion. And I think that's a huge piece of it. So I tell people when they ask, I'm an abortion clinic escort because I am Jewish, not in spite of being Jewish. Mm. And I think that's an important distinction to make. So I have a Jewish dad and a Catholic mom, and I grew up Lutheran because in the town that I grew up, the Jews there basically said you've got to you can only be Jewish in your house if you're going to sort of be a part of this community, which would have meant leaving sort of my mom's traditions behind, and my parents didn't feel good about that. And the Catholic community where I grew up said you guys are all going to hell. And so that neither of those were like a viable option for my parents. And so they brought us to Lutheran church where the whole family could go. My dad did the parts of the service that, made sense for him as a Jew. He like Jews don't really kneel. So he never knelt for prayer. He would sit instead. There were modifications like that, that were totally acceptable in the Lutheran community in which I grew up. And so it wasn't until I was in my like mid 20s, I guess early 20s, that it occurred to me that I had not spent any time with institutional Judaism. I had grown up celebrating Jewish holidays, but it had always been with family. It had never been sort of in a broader Jewish community or like a synagogue community. And to be honest, I walked into a synagogue for the first time when I was 23. And went to my first Shabbat service, so Friday night service. And I left and I called my parents and said, you know, parents, I love you. You did a lot of things right. But you chose wrong for me. I'm Jewish. Like after one service, I walked out and was like, this is where I'm supposed to be. And for me, a huge piece of that is and a friend of mine, I want to give her credit. In Nashville, she is a Black woman converted to Judaism, grew up Black in the South, and she talked about being a young Black girl growing up where she grew up and being really frustrated that as a Christian, that anything her parents were telling her at home, you need to work twice as hard to get half as much. Mm. But then she was going to church and hearing like anything good that happens to you, it's because God did it. And anything bad that happens to you is because Satan did it. And so it removes personal responsibility
right.
from the equation. And she was really frustrated by that. And I think that, so I'm using that not because I'm a Black woman from the South, but because that explanation really resonated with me as like, I also chose Judaism because a central tenet is, it comes from the Mishnah, from this, it's called Pirkei Avot. And the exact quote says, "You are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to desist from it."
Ooh, I love that.
It's this idea that everybody has an obligation every single day, all the time, to be contributing to progress. And so the work that happens here on earth is the most important work. There is no sort of like, if you do good, you'll go to heaven, or if you don't do good, you're going to hell. It's like today, there's another saying that I love that says like, if the Messiah comes and you are planting a tree, finish planting the tree, like, and then go greet the Messiah. Ooh. And so it's just this idea that you are responsible for the world around you. And also sort of in the Talmud, and culturally as well, like 83% of American Jews support abortion access. It is a vast majority. And those folks are saying that it should be legal in most or all cases. And Jewish law actually does not support what we think of as sort of like the common religious challenge to abortion, that life begins at conception. In fact, the fetus in Jewish law and Jewish tradition is explicitly part of and dependent on the woman's body throughout pregnancy. And that leads to the view that the woman's life is actually the primary life with which we're concerned. Mm. A fetus is considered property in Torah. Like there are some interpretations where if you harm a pregnant woman, like there's no further damage that's been done, indicating that like the fetus is not thought of as an additional life. Like you've harmed a person, period. But there's also like in Orthodox communities, a commandment, well, in all Jewish communities, but it's really followed in Orthodox communities. There's a commandment to be fruitful and multiply. And so abortion is not necessarily a like first choice birth control method certainly for religious Jewish women, or for really observant Jewish women. But it is actually recommended for women for whom carrying a pregnancy to term would be dangerous. And so like Jewish law actually says, have an abortion because the life of the woman is more important than the life of the unborn fetus. And that runs pretty counter to like Christian thinking on abortion, which like Judaism, there's a spectrum in Christianity, right? So you have folks who are Christian who absolutely support abortion access. But typically when you have anti is standing in front of a clinic, they are standing in front of a clinic also because of their faith. Right. And because of sort of this belief that life begins at conception. And to be honest, like I don't fault folks for that. Like if I believed as ardently as they do, well, in fact, I do believe as ardently as they do, because I'm also standing out in front of the clinic, that life does not begin at conception. And honestly, for me, even if it did, I would still be an abortion clinic escort, because I still think that women should ultimately have the choice, or people seeking abortions should still have the choice of what happens to their body.
That was all amazing. And I'm like learning all these things about Judaism as you're talking and all the facts, and this is fantastic. I just keep getting this image of like you, young woman going to the abortion clinic, and then the antis like doing like a Billie Jean, or I'm sorry, like a Beat It-esque like Michael Jackson music video, like kind of fighting like, like picket signs and stuff outside the building. I just keep getting it in my mind, and it, I don't know, it's just fantastic. I wanted to get something kind of the end of what you were talking about. We talked a lot about policy just so far in this conversation, as well as previous episodes, and I want to kind of shift this to looking at healthcare. You mentioned a lot about women's bodies, and how those are politicized, both narratively, both in the movement, but also with policy and how we talk about it, and then legislate around it. And then, you know, obviously who's doing that legislating and who's making those decisions, and then healthcare to have in general. And also, yeah, with your current work now with financial security, with working class folks, like, how does that all interplay?
Yeah, so that's such a great question. I think the financial security question is so important. As I mentioned, people who have access to really high quality sex education, but also who have access to really excellent healthcare, are not only less likely to seek an abortion, but they're also more likely to be wealthier. And so if you are financially secure, you have a lot more choices. Abortions are not inexpensive, and Medicaid actually only covers abortion in a few states. And there are a lot of restrictions on using Medicaid. Like, for example, you have to have Medicaid in the state that says it's okay to use Medicaid coverage. And you also have to receive your abortion in that state. So if there is sort of any complication, if you need a late term abortion, only a few clinics in the country provide those, and you may have to travel. There are really great groups like the National Abortion Access Fund, and they provide transportation, money, and also money generally for folks to be able to access abortion. Most women of reproductive age in the United States do not live in a county with a clinic, and most abortions happen in a clinic. They don't happen in a doctor's office. They don't happen in a hospital. And so if you don't have the financial sort of ability to procure an abortion, you might be forced to carry a pregnancy to term. And then you certainly have the adoption option. But you also then might have a child that you really can't afford. You couldn't afford the $450 for the abortion, which likely tells me that you can't afford the $1 million to raise a child over 18 years, you know? The other piece that I didn't mention, you asked sort of like who makes healthcare legislation. So like the Affordable Care Act was passed by Congress, and that is that's sort of like the broad strokes legislation. Mm-hmm. But then what happens is HHS actually flushes out like what all of the rules mean.
What is Congress, HHS?
The Department of Health and Human Services. Thanks. And that's a federal department. There's a Secretary of Health and Human Services that's appointed by the president. And everybody who works in that department is just like a regular civilian, right? So the president will appoint the head of that department, and they can sort of shape policy, but the rules really happen sort of at that kind of civilian bureaucratic level. And things like the Affordable Care Act don't come along all that often. Like that was amazing for women to get certainly the no pre-existing condition restriction from sort of your health insurance provider. It allowed folks to stay on their parents' insurance until they were 26. It allowed access to forms of contraception for free or for a really, really reduced cost. And so there's a lot of really excellent stuff that came out of the Affordable Care Act. There have been, obviously, you both know this, there have been just like is battle after battle, right, against Republicans in Congress who are trying to strip away some of that coverage. Trump has actually said that he would like to take away the piece about pre-existing conditions, which would not be good probably for really anybody. And all of that is pretty challenging, but you also have rules like the gag rule, which prevent doctors from referring patients to abortions, even if the patient requests that information. It prevents clinics that are receiving federal funding from being able to provide abortions or refer to abortion care services. So it really is about access. Policy and access are really inextricably linked in the world of abortion, because it does require, like, it's a medical procedure. It requires a doctor, right? There's, you know, this isn't something that, like, and I say that, people can go out and procure their own abortions, but women die. Like, the result of home abortion is death. And not all the time, but a lot of the time.
The fact that it can happen is not good.
And then the fact that it doesn't need to happen is the biggest issue.
Right. Exactly. Like, we talk about, you see, that's why you see the image of, like, the coat hangers, because women used to use coat hangers to try to give themselves an abortion. And you can imagine that putting a coat hanger inside your body could do a lot of damage if you don't know what you're doing, which nobody using a coat hanger did.
Or does.
Hopefully no longer does, but
yeah.
I mean, I guess the moment we're in.
Yeah. You got to do what you got to do, I guess. But like, then that highlights the importance of fighting the good fight, right? And like, it's interesting because like Trump actually, so during these last elections, he kind of like softened his talk on pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. And people are like, oh no, like, no, I'm going to keep them. I'm going to make sure that they're there. It's like, but you're not doing anything to actually keep them there. Like, you're giving the green light to everybody to continue to change that. And like, I don't fucking know. I'm not Congress. So
it's, well, but I, like, we all should be, because this is absurd. There are a gazillion abortion restrictions passed every year. Many of them unconstitutional. But they're what's called sort of like a trigger law, which means that if Roe v. Wade, which was decided in 1973, is overturned or sort of chipped away at by the Supreme Court, all of those laws that have been passed will immediately go into effect. And so you see things like in Alabama or in West Virginia, the recent legislation there, voters in Alabama recently approved a measure that gives fetuses legal personhood status. And in West Virginia, voters approved an initiative that said that nothing in the Constitution, quote, secures or protects a right to abortion or requires the funding of abortion, which means that abortion can essentially become illegal immediately if Roe is overturned. And with Kavanaugh now on the Supreme Court, there's a real fear that that's going to happen.
I always found that fascinating that we can make this big president, as far president set in policy, whether that be a court case or a policy or whatever, and then it's a huge thing, and then like under new administration or through whatever processes are make sense, it can be like overturned or chipped away at it. So it's like these things, like, I would say they don't matter, because obviously the Affordable Care Act matters, and they tried to chip away at it, and they haven't been successful. But who's to say how long that lasts, and who's to say how long, you know, Roe v. Wade lasts? And it's just like, nothing is finite at all. And they're so important with people's lives, like literally people's lives are at stake. So it always just fascinates me about how fragile they are, you know?
Colin, like, what you're saying is so critical, because I think to be honest, I think a lot of folks were really complacent when President Obama was in office, because there was, and President Obama was, I'm a big fan, but he did not do a lot of things right. Right. Like he deported a ton of people. Yeah. Like there's a lot that we can talk about sort of there. But there was a general complacency that I think has been removed, certainly with this, new administration. And I remember, like, right after the election, so I've been a clinic escort since 2012. So this will be I'm like exiting my sixth year of doing this work. And I remember right after this election, the group that organizes the clinic escorts here in New York got like 500 phone calls in the week following the election saying, like, we want to come help volunteer. Like, we'll go through training. Like, please put us out on the sidewalk. And a huge piece of me was so excited about that, right? Like, it's never too late to show up and to get involved and to raise your voice. But a tiny part of me, and I'm not proud of feeling this way, but a tiny part of me was like, so where you been though?
Yes, like, we always talk about this. Yes.
Like we've been on the sidewalk. I have been on the sidewalk.
Right.
Like, people, women, I volunteer with a 78-year-old woman at the clinic that I'm at. She has been on the sidewalk for 55 years.
Right.
And so this isn't new. This did not just start. Mm-hmm. Trump did not just begin this. This has been happening. And like, where have people been? And again, part of that is like, you want, like, every issue cannot be everyone's issue. I feel really strongly about that. We don't need every single person to be an abortion clinic escort. We don't need every single person to be an environmental sort of like advocate. We don't, but like, where you do have the skills and where you do have, again, this ties to my sort of like Jewish faith, you are required to show up. And so for me, like, I have the skills, the patience, and the demeanor to be screamed at for 4 hours without responding.
Browntown does not. What'd you say? Yeah. Tee up. I'm right, phoning exactly.
That's why you we don't deal with that.
And be name called for literally hours every week. And at first it's exhausting, and then you start sort of tuning it out.
Become numb
but
to it.
I think
it's like, you said that last week, Timmy. Okay. You said that last week. You got anything new? Anything new? No. Okay.
Right. Exactly. Like, come out, give me some new material.
Get creative with this shit.
we did Hitler last week. Like,
there are other fascists. Come on, now Mussolini. Let's get creative. You know.
Right. And so I think that's part of it. But again, I also I'm a certified confidential victim advocate for victims of rape, or sexual assault and intimate partner violence. And again, I do that work because I have the capacity to do it. I think it can be really challenging. I worked with a woman a couple of years ago whose partner had poured gasoline all over her body, lit a match, and stood over her. And she showed up, and I'm the advocate, you know, I'm the person who she's talking to about this. And at the time I was 21. And I am a survivor of intimate partner violence myself. And so not only did I have like pretty extensive training, but I also had sort of the personal experience to know like how she might have been feeling, or to have a sense of how she might have been feeling. And I think, that's because I have the ability to do that work, I have an obligation to do it. And I think, again, coming back to those folks who called the abortion clinic hotline to say, like, we want to come volunteer. Many of them haven't. I'm going to be sort of straight about that. But I think, you know, folks got really excited after the election. And then, you know, for many people, for many women, for many white women, life got back to normal, right? Like, I live in New York. The policies that are being enacted, I don't want to say they don't have an impact on me, because they do. But I'm not living in poverty. I'm not sort of one paycheck away from disaster. If I needed an abortion, I could come up with the funding to have one. Mm. And so I think it's my responsibility to make sure that I don't get complacent, and to help sort of remind other white folks, like, and people generally, men also, that like, just because things are going all right for you doesn't mean they're going all right for everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I feel that.
This could easily be like a 4-hour podcast.
sorry, I feel there's so much.
No. I mean, like, don't be sorry. This is one thing I love about what you're saying is that, and some of it's rooted in your faith, but also I think rooted in just being people in the world. And I preach this in all the spaces I traverse through, is that we have a responsibility. Mm-hmm. This is required. Even if it doesn't affect you, like you just mentioned, like people with means or men, like this still affects you when the bottom is when the most marginalized people are lifted up in any capacity, whether it's your policy, through the narrative change, whatever. It's like we all benefit. So why would it behooves you in the world? So why would you not try to be part of it? And with that, one thing that I always preach about art, especially in art and activism and like narrative change and all that, I think. In previous years, it always seems kind of fluffy, or it seems like not as important. I was thinking about this as you were talking, and after I asked kind of a question about how policy is really more fickle than we think. Mm-hmm. Policy is fickle. The way people think about things and the broad stroke narrative, it seems to be even more permanent than that, right? decades ago, we were having the same problems, if not worse, with mass incarceration and policing. But we're seeing steps, even though they may not be underneath the framework that we believe in, we've seen steps towards progress. I think those steps will stay. I hope they will stay, right? Because yeah. I think that's because the narrative has changed. And part of that is because of technology. Part of that is because of art. So I kind of want to, I think we've touched on this throughout this conversation thus far, but I want to touch on social movements, particularly mm-hmm. Me Too, but just generally speaking, mm-hmm. and how the narrative has changed, and problematic in some capacity. But because the narrative is changing, we're seeing the promise of policy possibly changing and the promise of folks understanding things more. And because of that, it is my view that because the narrative is changing, because of art, because of a lot of different reasons, that we will continue to progress. And it may be very incremental, maybe very small steps. But I believe that it'll be everything. Things change the way we want to see it. It'll be incremental. But to get to that radical approach and to that holistic approach, we have to fire off kind of all cylinders. It might be small, but we're able to do that because of narrative change, because of culture changing, because of all these kind of broader things that are not tangible like we like them to be, but they're things mm-hmm. that are really going to stay, whereas policy may not always do that. How do I form that into a question? thinking of Me Too.
Please respond to
all things I just jibber-jabbered. What role do social movements and just the narrative play into everything we talked about? Policy, your experiences with people on a very micro level.
I feel like we could talk about that for, like the next 12 hours, but I think
one soundbite real quick.
Exactly. No. You mentioned Shout Your Abortion earlier. And I think that's sort of a, kind of a well-known example here of storytelling and narrative and how art influences, culture and like people make policy. Policy doesn't come out of the sky. Yes. Like, people are responsible for creating, passing, mm-hmm. And enacting policy. And so I think, if we get to, if we're electing really excellent, thoughtful, compassionate people to office, I think our policy will be more thoughtful and more compassionate. And I think we get there, even with the folks we have in office, through storytelling and through media and through narrative. And I think these kinds of issues can feel really tense, but they can also feel really challenging if you personally haven't experienced them. And I go back and forth on this because I'm like, I feel like people should be able to put themselves in other people's shoes. Like, you shouldn't have to live through something to understand why it is either fair or unfair. You know, like, I don't have to be a Black person in America to be like pretty confident that racism is shitty. Like,
it's great. I love it. I find that shit every day.
Totally fine with that. You know, and you don't have to be a survivor of assault to understand that assault is a problem. Like, intimate partner violence is a problem. It actually costs the United States like $8.5 billion a year. Intimate partner violence does. It's really, really expensive. 10 million people a year in this country are physically abused by their partner. 1 in 4 of these folks are women. 1 in 9 are experiencing severe, 1 in 9 men, excuse me, experience severe intimate partner violence. And 15% of all violent crime in the United States is domestic violence. If we eliminated domestic violence, the crime rate would fall 15%. Like, that is incredible, right? And a huge piece of that is like what you said with media, with storytelling, with saying, like, sitting down and talking to each other about it, right? And I want to be careful because I don't want to put the burden on survivors to educate everyone else. I don't want to put the burden on folks who have gotten an abortion to have to go out and tell their story if they don't want to. Mm-hmm. But I want there to be space for people to do that. I wish the comments section just like didn't exist anywhere, because the comments section is
awful,
just horrible. But there is the best example I can think of is around sort of like narrative. And I'll get to, I want to spend like 2 seconds on Me Too also, because I think that's really important. But the best example I can think of around sort of narrative specifically related to intimate partner violence is a question, well, why don't you just leave? Mm. Right? Like, that's a really easy question to ask. And if you ever talk to someone about their experience in an intimate partner violence situation, a survivor, there will be about 78 good reasons why that person did not just leave. And for a lot of folks, that's like a really clarifying moment. Like, oh, I didn't realize that your partner said that they would kill the pets if you left, and your children would have been devastated if your pets died. I didn't understand that you didn't leave because your partner said, if you leave, I will kill you. Knowing that a fifth of homicide victims with restraining orders are murdered within 2 days obtaining the restraining order, and a third are murdered in the first month. And so we're not talking about like, well, just walk out the front door, sweetie. We're talking about folks who don't have access to their passport, their social security card, that like the offender might have taken all those things. The offender might have opened up lines of credit in their name. This person's credit might be ruined, and they might be financially unable to support themselves if they walk out the door. This person might be stalking or sort of tracking their movements, making it really hard for that person to leave. They might be showing up at work. Most women who have sort of workplace violence incidents, it's because their abuser showed up at their job. When we think about this stuff, like when I was in an abusive relationship, I didn't leave because I lived with my partner. We had one car and it belonged to him. He often controlled access to my cell phone. He actually had me delete Colin's number from my phone because he felt that Colin was a threat to him.
Did Dad know that? Did you tell me that?
I mean, Colin is a threat. That's not staff.
It's wow. Colin is the most wonderful person in the world, and but I mean, that's why I have your number memorized. Like, so there are like really real ramifications to this stuff that that people don't think about, you know. And you asked sort of in the prep for this, like, what's the value of storytelling, and what's the value of kind of sharing your personal story versus just using like facts or just using I don't know. It's, again, you shouldn't need to hear someone's personal story to decide that domestic violence is a problem. Right. But I think it absolutely helps, right?
Yeah. I mean, but when we also get into the point where, like, you know, something is told and it's like, how do you believe this person, right? Like, mm-hmm. And I think with the current administration, that's kind of like where I've started seeing it more so, I guess. It's like we have someone who has been caught saying specific things. People have come out and accused in certain ways. I don't know. And that's kind of like the problem, right? So like, we're hearing these stories, but like, how many times is it that you get like, oh no, like, oh, she's full of shit, or he's full of shit, or, you know, like, oh, that's not really the case, blah, blah, this, that, and the fifth. It's like, I don't know.
No, and you're so right. I mean, there's something so damaging to survivors about having to hear that, right? Like, not being believed is like re-experiencing assault all over again. And so I think the Kavanaugh hearings I truthfully didn't really follow them. I watched part of them, but I couldn't watch most of it. Because it was like, I felt like I was consuming assault. I felt like I was, and I'm, like I said, trained to respond to assault, trained to respond to domestic violence. And so sitting there feeling really helpless, like I couldn't do anything for
anyone,
for the survivor or for anyone in that moment, you know. And then you log on to Facebook and everybody, me too, was actually really hard. for me, because everyone you know is wanting to talk about their sort of their assault. And it's, again, feeling like you can't do something for someone is for me the worst feeling. And so and feeling like you're consuming it and like people are reading it and feeling this sort of like pleasure at knowing this thing about someone is really tricky. I don't talk publicly very often about, like, I'll mention it. Like, I'm a survivor of domestic violence. I'm a survivor of sexual assault, but I don't write the long Facebook posts. I don't, because I feel like it becomes harder and harder. And Tarana Burke talks about this. Like, it becomes harder to control the narrative when it's outside of your body.
Yeah.
And you feel like you're not then in control of your own story. You feel like people are questioning true things that have happened to you. And like women and generally people who have been assaulted don't lie. There is like, folks may not remember all the details. That's a side effect of trauma, or of shock, that you can't remember every single thing that happened to you. And I think, you know, people have a hard time believing that, but if I'm like, what were you doing last Tuesday night at 7 PM? You'd probably have to look at your calendar and you'd probably have to, like, if I asked you like what happened in the conversation, if you got into a heated conversation with somebody and I said, I want you to tell me every single thing that came out of that person's mouth and out of your mouth during that conversation, you wouldn't remember. And like multiply that by 1,000, and that's what being assaulted is. So, you know, it's important to me to sort of communicate that, like, there's a memory component, there's an emotional component, there's a trauma component. And there's also this component of feeling like you want your own story to be told in a way that feels genuine and honest to you. And a lot of times media distorts that, and like sharing your story distorts that. And so a lot of folks are reticent to share their story, because they don't want to have to answer to what they know to be a factual and very traumatic experience for them.
Yeah, that's so powerful. And speaking of Tarana Burke, I want to kind of mention, there's a video of her and Mariam Kaba. Mariam Kaba is interviewing her, and it's fantastic. Everyone should watch it. One thing she's talking about with the movement of Me Too, and just, you know, sidebar, Tarana Burke started Me Too a decade ago, really kind of centered around Black women and girls fighting against sexual assault and kind of what that looks like, and how we can really, again, change the narrative and change how we support people going through this, and how trauma can actually have a place where folks can talk about this and heal. But she says,
if you define this movement by how the media says it is, then you will definitely be left out. If you allow the media to tell you what the Me Too movement is, then none of us are included in that. And so that's not a movement. We are movement people. We know what a movement is. The hashtag and what's happening on TV and who's going to jail and who's, that's not a movement. Those are actions that are reactions to things that have happened. And that's the media's response to it. What the media is doing with hashtag MeToo is not a movement. What we're building is a movement.
She also gets into how it's kind of in like a whitewash, so to speak. It's just like, you know, who's going to jail? Who's the next, you know, quote unquote casualty of Me Too, which is really just kind of like stingingly like awful and disgusting to hear too, right? I even remember like my own experience. I went to Cabo for a bachelor party for a friend of mine, and someone couldn't go, and they're like, "Oh, don't get Me Too'd." And it's like, well, I don't assault women, so like I'm gonna be okay, like. Right. That's a common thing, right? Where do you even go with that as far as like, you know, what's men's responsibility is not to assault women, but also it's more than that as far as what can we do to challenge our friends and colleagues. And we talked about that before with previous episodes, but also like, how do we look at ourselves, you know?
Yep. I love that. Well, and the response that so many men have had is infuriating, doesn't even begin to describe how I feel about hearing men say like, well, now I have to be like too careful, and like, I can't joke around anymore. And like, women have taken all my, I'm like, if not assaulting someone means that you are no longer having fun, then like, you have a whole other set of issues that we should work through. But like, this is common fucking sense. And like, pardon my language, but I feel like we overthink. Like, I don't want to say me. I'm not a man. I think men tend to overthink. Like, suddenly they're having attention called to shitty behavior that they've been doing for thousands of years. And we've now put a spotlight on it and said, like, oh, that thing that you're doing, grabbing a woman in the office, making a joke as someone walks down the street, catcalling, like, that shit isn't okay. And I think men are having a really defensive reaction to that. And as frustrating as it is for me, I think our reaction to that, like, in my sort of like private, like, venting, I'll yell about it, right? And I'll get upset and I'll get really irritated and I'll call everybody that I know and love and like yell at them about it. But like, when confronted with catcalling on the street, for example, I found that it's actually much more effective to like stop what I'm doing if I feel safe enough to do so, introduce myself and ask for an apology. And that has been a, like, all of a sudden you're like a real person. You're not just like some woman walking past who's like a piece of meat. You're like, oh, like, I just like screamed at this person for no reason. And so using sort of those like teachable, I hate the phrase teachable moments, but like using those sort of like teachable moments to help move people. Like, nobody's ever changed their behavior because you made them feel stupid. No one's ever changed their behavior because you screamed at them. Maybe short term they will, right? Sure. But like, ultimately long term, then people end up resenting you. And while, like I said, while it is so frustrating for women, for the most part, to have to like educate every cisgender man around them, folks aren't gonna do better unless we ask them to. But I also think that there is absolutely an onus on men to like do the fucking work. Like, and that means two things to me. That means that you examine yourself, that you sort of sit back and say, like, where have I messed up with women in my life? Yeah. Where have I made a joke that wasn't okay, or made a comment that wasn't okay, or where have I made someone feel really uncomfortable? And also, when you see it happening, that you say something, like, die on every hill. There is no hill too small. Like, this is, for me, like, if you're sitting in a room and someone uses the N-word, like, you fucking say something about that. You don't sit there. You don't pretend like it didn't happen. You don't, like, and for me, like, I feel the same way about, like, gendered comments. Like, somebody calls someone a bitch, or somebody, you know, somebody uses like an inappropriate sort of like makes an inappropriate joke about a woman. Like, call that shit out. Don't like let folks know that like you're not gonna let that fly, because people will only do what they think you'll let them get away with. And so if you don't let them get away with stuff, they're not gonna do it anymore. At least in front of you, and that's a starting point.
Facts.
Yeah.
I mean, all that adds to, like, I mean, I have so many thoughts there, but we'll do a part two.
We're going to have to do a part two.
I think all that adds to what I like to say is, like, women's lives are more important than men's feelings. And, like,
yes.
You know what I mean? It's like, I think with a lot of the rhetoric now, and like, it's a war on men and all those kind of things that kind of get to what you're saying, is folks like feel a certain type of way. And it's like, you can feel that way, but like, this. Dying on the small hills, like you say, which I fucking love.
Oh, we're going to quote that.
Dying on the small hills and all this stuff, it's all important. It all eats away and fights back, even in a very tiny way, to rape culture. And rape culture adds to policy, or adds to narrative shift, and adds to a language, and that adds to policy. And policy is written by words. Like, words matter. And so it's like, if you're in your feelings, well, you'll figure that out. But, like, women's lives are more important right now. And you can say that for a lot of things, but that's, like, the only thing I go to a lot when it comes to narrative and art and culture and all that, all those good things.
Well, I love it. It, as always, we like to kind of like wrap things up with like what are things we can do, and you very much put it out, as you know, call it out. You see, should say shit, you know, like, don't don't just let it happen, you know, and take responsibility, I think, is a big one. And I know that we at Browntown have talked about, you know, that specific thing. You know, you start with your friends, right? You start with your boys. You start with, you know, motherfuckers where it was normal in high school to be saying dumb shit. And then now you're like, yo, you know what? Maybe we should grow up at some point. You know, maybe we don't need to be doing all that. Also, other things you can do is to continue to fund organizations like some of the ones that you work at that are doing great work, right? And they're constantly doing it. It's like people are like, oh, well, no one's really helping this. No one's really doing that. Well, that's just because you haven't Googled. But there's so many people out there doing great work and constantly trying to alleviate a lot of these issues. And not only that, but when, for example, as you were mentioning, is like people who've already been abused or in whatever way, you know, having outlets and having ways for them to reach out and be able to better themselves, because that's what we want to do at the end of the day. You know, we don't want to be living in this bullshit like that. But Zoe, it was so great having you on here. I'm so glad. We're definitely gonna have to bring you back. Yeah, just keep this going, I just learned so much, like, right now, just in so many places. But yeah, any shout outs you want to give out?
I think, really quick, a lot of this data, I want to be data conscious here.
Hey, we'll put it on the website, I promise, but tell us.
Yeah. So, a lot of my data came from the Guttmacher Institute. But I also, absolutely want to give shout outs to Planned Parenthood and local abortion clinics, to the National Organization of Women that organizes abortion clinic escorts all over the country. To Urban Resource Institute and the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And finally to, TESA, which is an organization, with which I volunteered, for a number of years in Colorado Springs, doing work with survivors of intimate partner violence. And just like a really great, like a shining example of a local organization that's truly changing the lives of the folks who walk through their doors. And then my last and final shout out is to you guys. I think it is, so rarely are people like, yeah, you want to talk about abortion for an hour and a half? And I do, I always do. And so it is like such an honor and a privilege to be here with you all. But I also like absolutely want to commend you, because I think it can be really hard, to have these conversations, and it can be really hard to be sitting there like as a man and hearing me be like, here are all the ways that men are trash. And you are, I appreciate you. I appreciate you taking the time to have the conversation, to learn. And I'm excited for all of us to go die on a bunch of hills together.
Yeah, dying on all the hills.
Dying on all the hills.
One thing I thought about earlier, and coming up to this podcast, I wasn't sure I was going to mention it or not. Kind of the same reasons you mentioned to me, Zoe, but I've previously been like accused of assault, which I didn't do, and like I don't talk about it because A, I don't really think about it because I didn't do anything, but B, because I don't want to be part, I don't want to add to the folks who think of this war on men is actually a thing when it's really a myth, and I don't want to add to that conversation because I feel like part of it's like, oh, look, like, see this one time this person lied, so like that's the narrative. It's like, no, that's the current narrative, and we're changing that because that's not, the stats don't actually point to that. And it's actually a super, super, super minuscule percent of the time where anyone is not telling the truth about these things. It's always been an interesting thing, especially with the movement happening recently. It's like I'm championing this like every day. But it's like, what does it look like when you're in the small percentage where it has been used against you as far as movement wise, but you have in a situation where someone was using this unfairly. So it's always something, when you mentioned earlier about like men looking at themselves, looking at their dealings in the world, and even like knowing that and owning that, but being a champion for gender equity and what that looks like, and then being a champion for the narrative shift, but also being in the small percentage that is abnormal. It's been something I've been processing for years now, but also in this conversation, it's like, how do you know that and own that about yourself, but also not mention that, but also just know that that's a rare incident, and the narrative needs to be that believe women, this shit fucking happens. And how do you organize against it?
Colin, it breaks my heart that is something that happened to you. For every possible reason. But I also am, you bring up such an excellent point. And like, your story matters. Your story is also a part of this movement. Your story as a Black man who was unjustly accused of sexual assault is like part of a long history in the United States of Black men being unjustly accused of sexual assault. And I think there is always room in the conversation for that. And I also am so conscious as a survivor who has not been believed, and who hasn't been treated particularly well by medical professionals, by other men, et cetera. One of the things that I admire so much about you is that time and place, like, you know when to sort of talk about that, and you know when to let survivors speak, because there is, whether or not this is, it's not fair. I'm just going to say it's not fair. It's not fair that your experience with assault can't be as much in the spotlight as a survivor's experience right now. Because I think as a country, we aren't ready yet for the nuance. We aren't ready yet to have the conversation in a way that includes your story in a meaningful, robust way, because what ends up happening is we say, well, if they lied about him, then, you know.
Right, well, right. They all look over here. So that means they're all like null and void.
Right, exactly.
It's not even like I feel the need to like talk about it at all, but it's like, if I mention this, then folks can grapple onto this and then use this to champion another
conversation.
Yeah, and to hurt women's lives and be harmful. And so it's like the fact that I can't even mention it without it being co-opted in a way that shouldn't be is shitty. I don't like care to mention it or not. I don't care. But it's just like the fact that it can be taken. Okay, well, see this, you know, she lied. So therefore, like, no,
I should have connected that is like to the idea that like stories are co-opted and co-opted. Like once you share your story, it doesn't belong to you anymore.
I didn't want to make it about me or men like at all. But at the same time, I feel like that process is rare.
It happens, and we have to talk about it, and we have to fucking reconcile that. And like, as a society, we fucked up, and you paid the price for it. And like, that's like the same thing that happens to women. Like, as a society, we fuck up, and women pay for it.
Yeah.
So like, an individual woman suffers because we can't get our shit together in this like patriarchal society in which we live. And like, that's not fair. I mean, it's like less than 3% of people who say that they were assaulted are lying about it. And so when we just statistically, that's like so unusual. It's like so rarely the case. And I think a huge piece of that is because when you report or when you say that you've been assaulted, like you are treated as if you were a criminal. And so it's, you're not incentivized to come forward as a survivor.
Right. You don't get cookies or like anything.
Yeah, no, it's the opposite of cookies. This is a story for another time, but yeah, it's the opposite of cookies. And, so that's you. I mean, it's a great question. I'm not really answering it very well, but essentially like that happens. Like men are falsely accused. Black men are falsely accused. And we have to do better about that because it's not, your life was changed pretty significantly because of that. And that's not any fairer than it was that I was assaulted and my life was changed. And I wish that our stories could be told at the same time. And right now my fear is that they can't.
This is why we're doing what we're doing. And like, as for me, it's like, doing this episode, you know, I like sat and really thought about like my own actions, you know, whether I was a shorty or not, that's not an excuse, you know, or whether, you know, I was in a place and time, that's not an excuse. And so for me, it was very much being like, it's like, oh yeah, David, like you've changed. Like you're not the same shitty kid you were, but like there's still a lot of places where I have messed up. And there's a lot of places where like I, you know, could have, would have, should have in a different light. And it's like, it is kind of hard. It's kind of hard to be like, damn, dude, you really fucked up, you know? And it's like, yo, like, or you let this shit happen. You let that shit slide. And, you know, a big thing is like, how does one, you know, then deal with regret? you know, and then the goal for that is, you know, to not make that mistake again, to keep pushing, and, you know, and it's a struggle. Everyone's out here doing it. But as always, thank you so much, Zoe, for hanging out with us. This shit was dope. We'll be seeing you back at some other time, I promise. Stay well in New York. We'll see you back here in Chicago whenever you're ready for it. As always, from Bourbon and Brown Town, stay black, stay brown, stay queer.
Stay tuned, stay turnt.
We out here. See you next time.
Believe women.
For more information on episode guests, related media, and topics, check out the episode notes. Follow us on social media at SoapboxPO and or visit soapboxpo.com/podcast.